And Radio Derb is on the air. That was one of Haydn's Derbyshire Marches, played on fife and drum. And here is your consonantly genial host, John Derbyshire, with some reflections on the past week's Sturm und Drang, to go with the fife and drum, you see. It will be short measure this week, I'm afraid, listeners. I have to get up very early Saturday morning so that I can go and massacre peasants in Pennsylvania. I therefore have to put the podcast to bed earlier than usual. If that leaves you hankering for more of the Derbish nectar, I urge you to sample my monthly diary, the November edition of which was posted at vidare.com and uns.com, with many cheerful facts about US history, nuclear physics, national character, Chinese orthography, Hebrew numerology. Sorry, excuse me. The producer's talking into my earpiece. Excuse me. Oh, did I? Oh, okay. All right, sure. Okay. Apparently I misspoke. I'm going to massacre pheasants in Pennsylvania, not peasants. Sorry about that. Although, should any unruly peasants cross my path while I'm armed and loaded out there and fail to accord me the dignity and respect to which I am accustomed, I shall not be responsible for the consequences. This week started off with another Muslim terrorist attack, this one on the campus of Ohio State University in Columbus. Shortly before 10 a.m. Monday, a Somali immigrant, a student at the university, deliberately drove his car into a group of people, injuring several. Then he got out and started stabbing bystanders with a butcher knife. Fortunately, a campus cop was nearby. He shot the Muslim dead. There were 13 victims altogether, 3 with broken bones, 1 with possible internal injuries, the rest listed as having moderate or minor injuries. Could have been worse. The terrorist was identified as Abdul Artan. His age was given as 18, but that is obviously a lie. In photographs, he looks to be at least 30, with a well-developed case of male pattern baldness. The incident is mainly noteworthy for illustrating the utter absence of any sense or reason in our immigration and so-called refugee policies. Before proceeding, let me justify that adjective, so-called. Abdul Artan moved with his family from Somalia to Pakistan in 2007. 7 years after that, in 2014, he was admitted to the USA as a refugee and was granted legal permanent residency. So, after 7 years in Pakistan, how was he a refugee? Is Pakistan a country that people need refuge from? Is it a country that Muslims need refuge from? If it is, we're in trouble. The population of Pakistan is 202 million. If any significant portion of them need refugee status, that's millions of people. In fact, there is no reason to grant refugee status to anyone from Pakistan. Sure, the place is dirt poor and politically corrupt, but there's no civil war or famine. Nor is there any threat of Pakistan being destroyed by external agency. It's a nuclear power, for crying out loud. So, in what sense were Artan's family, resident there 7 years, in what sense were they refugees? People often say, concerning genuine Muslim refugees, driven from their homes in places like Syria, people often say that their brother Muslim nations should take them in. Well, in the case of the Artans, assuming they genuinely were fleeing from something or other in Somalia, a questionable assumption in itself given the history of fraud in these cases, but even assuming that, Muslim Pakistan did indeed step up and take them in. How did they then become America's responsibility? The answer is that the USA has an insatiable appetite for Somali immigrants. Ann Corcoran has dug out the numbers over at Refugee Resettlement Watch. We've taken in 8,000 Somalis so far this year. Last year it was 9,000. Year 2014, it was also 9,000. Clicking back through the years from there, 8,000, 5,000, 3,000, 5,000, 4,000, 2,500. That last low number was for 2008, when family reunification was suspended after the State Department tried out a DNA testing program that exposed widespread fraud. Strangers claiming to be family members. The suspension was annulled in 2009 with no further effort to reduce fraud after the Obama administration came in. Continuing to scan backwards, in 2007, we took in 7,000 Somalis. The previous year, 10,000, then 10,000, 13,000, 2,242. Whoa, what happened there? Only 242? Oh, that was 2002, the year after 9/11. Yes, incredibly. We actually cut back on importing Somali Muslims the year after 9/11. The cutback only lasted a few months, though. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The most astounding statistic of the 21st century is that the USA has taken in more Muslims for settlement in the 15 years since 9/11 than it did in the 15 years before. Not that we were exactly slack before, certainly not in the case of Somali Muslims. Anne's numbers show that during the Clinton administration we took in 36,000 Somalis. And these are Somalis, the group of all Muslim groups with the highest proportion of swivel-eyed fanatics and the lowest proportion of persons with any useful skill or literate in anything but Islamic mumbo-jumbo. Yet, as those numbers show, the USA has an insatiable appetite for more and more of them. When I say the USA, of course, I don't mean the ordinary people of America. Nobody cares what they want. The appetite belongs, in the first place, to the refugee importers, the so-called voluntary agencies, who get vast grants of federal money to aid them in their efforts and who pay their executives grand salaries. And, in the second place, to Midwestern meatpacking and food processing companies wanting cheap labour. It's all a nice little money racket, dressed up in humanitarian language. The precise voluntary agency involved in Artan's case was Catholic Charities of Dallas. They will not, of course, be held responsible for the actions of their protege. Nor will anyone be called on to explain how the mass importation of African Muslims helps the mission of the Catholic Church. Monday's attack also brought out the sanctimonious non-judgmentalism of our good white elites. One of those more seriously hurt was 68-year-old Emeritus Professor of Engineering William Clark. Quote from him, speaking the day after the attack, quote, "Before I pass judgment on this young man, I would like to see exactly what the circumstances are and exactly why he took the course of action that he chose." End quote. The circumstances, the root causes. It wasn't Mr. Artan's will, his agency, that brought about those injuries and his own death, you see. It was those pesky circumstances. Members of victim groups have no agency. They are the helpless playthings of circumstance. I haven't so far seen anyone quoted as saying that, as horrific as this attack was, if our diversity becomes a casualty, that would be worse. However, I've no doubt that somebody, somewhere, has said it. The flow of bracing good news that began in the small hours of November 9th continued last week with the death of Fidel Castro. This particular bit of news would have been even better if we'd heard that the tyrant had died slowly, screaming in agony, like so many of his victims. But one shouldn't hope for too much. Let's just be glad the old gangster is gone. Reactions were predictable. Cubans who had fled from Castro's communist dictatorship to the USA were dancing in the streets. Our own communists, people like New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, who honeymooned in Castro's Cuba, along with those useful idiots who are kindly disposed towards communism, like Barack Obama and Justin Trudeau, expressed various levels of regret. What's predictable is not generally very interesting, though. It's the unpredictable that always gets my attention. In that category, I'd give pride of place to the article by Katie Hopkins in Tuesday's Daily Mail. Katie's a sort of British Ann Coulter, only not quite so aggressive or intelligent. She's argumentative, nationalist, contrarian, and irreverent towards PC pieties. She went to Cuba to attend Castro's funeral. She stood in line for hours, all through the night, with Cubans, waiting to pay their respects, to walk past Castro's memorial in Revolution Square. She's smart enough to know that events like this are stage managed in a dictatorship, and that some people attend out of fear that not attending would bring punishment. She's frank about the poverty, the lies, and the fear that pollute life under communism. Still, she's honest enough to see some genuine sorrow and pride. Quote, "Patriotism, manifest in their flag draped around shoulders, and precious currency, young women selling cakes, keen that I take the notes home with me to remind me of their country when I leave. Pride in a small island, the David to America's Goliath, who fearlessly prevails against the odds. And a strong sense of family, where people stand together, stay together, keep strong for each other to make things better. End quote. There are a number of ways a human being can react to finding himself a native of one of these fly-blown Caribbean slum nations. One way, it would probably be my way, is to get the hell out of there to somewhere civilized. Another way, almost invariably futile and quite likely fatal too, is to take up the banner of freedom and justice and try to improve the place into a prosperous and open society. And another is to adopt an attitude of indifference to what happens politically and flaunt a defiant patriotic pride that anything native is at least better than foreign domination. The canonical expression of this attitude was the Greek in Byron's poem, living under Ottoman Turkish rule and fondly remembering the ancient Greek ruler Polycrates. Quote, a tyrant, but our masters then were still at least our countrymen. It's good to be reminded that human nature is not totally in thrall to the pleasure principle. I learnt this early. My childhood was spent among adults who couldn't stop talking wistfully, nostalgically about World War II, when they'd lived on starvation rations, their civil liberties severely curtailed, while fleets of enemy planes dropped bombs on their cities every night and their menfolk were shipped to the killing fields overseas. They remembered those days so fondly. There was none of this political bickering, they'd say. We were a real country then, all pulling together. So, yes, Castro was a monster of cruelty and depravity who murdered thousands, including some who thought they were his friends, who lived high on the hog while his people went hungry, whose hatred of America almost caused a nuclear war. Good riddance to the swine. There is more to be said, though. In human affairs, there is always more to be said. Thanks to Katie Hopkins for saying it. Thursday this week, December 1st, was World AIDS Day. On the subject of AIDS in general, I really ought to feel more common sympathy than I do. Like people with AIDS, I myself suffer from an incurable disease of the immune system, kept at bay to date by the vigilant care of doctors and the background work of pharmaceutical researchers, to all of whom I am profoundly grateful. What dilutes my sympathy for AIDS sufferers is that my disease has never, like theirs, been elevated to an emblem of victimhood and its sufferers celebrated as sanctified martyrs. This is particularly unfair by comparison not only with my own diagnosis but with most other diseases of comparable malignancy, in that these other diseases arise mainly through random changes of unknown cause in the metabolism, while AIDS arises mainly as a result of promiscuous homosexual buggery. Behaviour which, whatever you may think about it from an aesthetic point of view, is easily avoided. AIDS is nonetheless a sacrament in the weird pseudo-religion of cultural Marxism. As such, it is of course vulnerable to the hostility of infidels. People like, to take a random example, Donald Trump. Fortunately, there are brave believers ready to defend the sacred flame. One such is my new pal Stephen Thrasher of BuzzFeed. Mr. Thrasher is a proud recipient of the 2012 Journalist of the Year Award from the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. I subjected you to a sample of his hysterical thrashing in our November 11th podcast, when he referred to the election result as, quote, a terrifying moment for America, end quote. Here he is this week warning us that, actual headline, under Donald Trump, the scourge of HIV/AIDS is going to get worse. This piece is Thrasher at his thrashiest. He thrashes, for example, over Trump not having mentioned AIDS in his healthcare policy statements. Well, Trump didn't mention my disease either. You could make a list of all the particular diseases he didn't mention, although that would be quite a task, as there would be several thousand items on the list. Why particularly should he have mentioned AIDS? Oh, right, because it's a cult Marx sacrament. Trump is also, Thrasher's Thrasher, is also, quote, generally anti-science. I seriously doubt that. Trump made his fortune by putting up tall buildings. You can't do that unless you have a strong respect for science. Within the science of physics, for example, it's dynamics, the study of things that are moving, that hogs all the glamour. But statics, the study of forces in stationary systems, is essential to creating large, stable structures. Statics has charms of its own, and some nifty equations too. In parentheses here, I'm sorry, but I can't help recalling a chapter heading in my high school applied math textbook that was a much quoted favourite with myself and all my male teen classmates. Quote, impulsive motions of a rigid body. I bet that was Stephen Thrasher's favourite too. Close parentheses. Immediately after those assertions, we get this about the Donald from the Thrasher. Quote, I am terrified that two of his most important picks, Vice President-elect Mike Pence and Health and Human Services Secretary nominee Tom Price, know exactly how to harm Americans, disproportionately black and or LGBT Americans, by way of HIV/AIDS. End quote. So Thrasher is terrified again, as he was by the election result. This guy spends a lot of time being terrified, or posing as being terrified. This time he's terrified because he thinks Pence and Price, quote, know how to harm Americans, end quote, especially black and homosexual Americans. So, does he think they will act on this knowledge? If he doesn't think so, why is he terrified? That's a pretty potent accusation Thrasher is making there. Pence and Price know how to harm Americans. This is a guy whose opinions get published in major broadsheet newspapers, in this case, The Guardian. As so often when faced with liberal opinionating nowadays, you feel you are in the realm of psychopathology. The basic position of homosexual activists like Thrasher is that they should be able to do anything they want to do, and that if dire consequences ensue, it's someone else's fault, and the rest of us should pay for it. Thrasher is plain and clear about this. Listen to him tell us, for example, about the moment he decided to vote for Mrs. Clinton. Quote, "The moment I picked was when she boldly denounced the criminalization of HIV, whereby individuals can be prosecuted for exposing someone else to the virus. Her finest moment to me." End quote. You got that? Mrs. Clinton's finest moment to Thrasher was when she said, "You shouldn't be prosecuted for giving AIDS to someone." I'd actually agree that if you give a communicable disease to someone unknowingly, you shouldn't be prosecuted. There's no crime without intent. Thrasher doesn't make that distinction, though. He thinks that any prosecution for AIDS transmission is, quote, "the criminalization of HIV," and that Mrs. Clinton's speaking out against what she called HIV criminalization laws was her finest moment. Good grief. AIDS is in most cases a behavioural disease, like lung cancer, morbid obesity, or cirrhosis of the liver. The role of government in suppressing such diseases is putting forth public information campaigns to discourage the causative behaviours. If the disease is communicable, like AIDS, it's also entirely proper to have laws against willful transmission. This is common sense. A commodity not much prized among homosexual activists. Columbia linguistics professor John McWhorter is a specimen of that very rare creature, a rational liberal. Professor McWhorter had an article in Time magazine, November 29th, chewing over the use and misuse of the term white supremacist. I'm going to leave you to read the article for yourselves. It's on the internet at time.com. Here in this segment, I'm just going to indulge myself in a short rumination on that same term, white supremacist. Engram says that the phrase white supremacist was unknown until the 1940s, and then underwent a leisurely rise in frequency through to the mid-1980s, and then took off like a rocket, and is still climbing fast. I've always been annoyed by the term because of its ambiguity. What is a white supremacist supposed to be, actually? I know a lot of people who regularly get called white supremacists, and they believe different things. So, here's what I'll do. I'll take a stroll along the spectrum of opinions, the holding of which will get you called a white supremacist by somebody somewhere. Ready to stroll? Let's stroll. The least racialistic of these opinions just argues, with no prejudice to any other race, that the USA has all the people it needs and should have a complete moratorium on immigration until the huge intakes of the past 50 years have been assimilated into a common American identity. The accurate term for such a person would be strong immigration restrictionist. But Rachel Maddow, Jamel Bowie, probably the New York Times, and likely the Wall Street Journal too, would call him, or her, a white supremacist. Proceeding along the spectrum, there are people who deduce from basic principles of biology, perhaps falsely, that localized groups of humans that have bred mostly among themselves for many, many generations will have distinctive group characteristics on heritable traits. That would include traits like intelligence and the various dimensions of personality, which are all heritable to some degree. These people get called white supremacists too, even though few of them, none at all to my knowledge, think that white Europeans cornered all the most desirable traits. If you ask them about intelligence, for example, they'll tell you that East Asians come out on top, with whites next, West and South Asians next, then Amerindians, then Africans, and then Australian Aborigines. A better descriptor for these people would be the one that I tried to float in We Are Doomed. Biologians. There's a subset in that group that I think fairly can be called white supremacists. Those are people who argue that, yes, East Asians may come out best on raw smarts, but they are short on some of the personality traits that help people to cohere into stable, free societies. Whites, these folk argue, whites are in a sort of Goldilocks position. Enough smarts to build modern civilizations, and the right mix of personality traits to keep them open and free, at least most of the time. Or at very least, more of the time than is the case with other races. For this Goldilocks view, I think white supremacist is not an unfair descriptor. It loses some of its vituperative power in this case, though, because the Goldilocks view belongs to the category of things that might be true. We don't know anything like enough about the underlying science to say whether or not it is true, but it's not illogical or preposterous. Believing things in that category doesn't make you a bad person, although it may turn out that you are honestly mistaken. Some other people will eschew biology or have no interest in it, but just appeal to simple empirical observation. At the present stage of human development, they'll say, nations that are established, mostly populated, and mostly run by people of white European extraction are the best nations to live in. This opinion is white supremacist, at least implicitly. The problem here is that it is an opinion very widely held by non-whites. Those boatloads of black Africans and brown West and South Asians heading north across the Mediterranean all seem to believe it on the revealed preference principle. Likewise, American blacks, vanishingly few of whom display any desire to flee from the horrid racism of US society to go live in Haiti or Ghana or Chad. A lot of East Asians believe it too. The current issue of The Economist has an article on the Chinese Communist Party's efforts to shut down so-called international schools. That is, private high schools teaching an international curriculum for kids planning to study abroad. The angle is, of course, that these schools are poisoning the minds of Chinese youngsters with Western liberalism. The problem for the government campaign against them is that they are very popular with China's big and fast-growing middle class. Quote from The Economist, "It is not just the super rich who have the aspiration or means to send their offspring abroad to attend university, some 57% of Chinese parents would like to do so, if they could afford it, according to the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. End quote. As always in matters of race, the level of hypocrisy here is very high. The next sentence is this one. Quote, even Chinese President Xi Jinping sent his daughter to Harvard, where she studied under a pseudonym. End quote. If you head out further along the spectrum of opinions that regularly get called white supremacist, you get to people who, without necessarily holding any opinions at all about the distribution of traits in different races, would just like freedom of association restored so they could live among their own kind, without being forced by law into contact with other races. I can't see any necessary notion of supremacy in that. White separatist would be the better term for these opinions. Then there are people who are fed up with Western society beating up on white people all the time and blaming them for all the world's ills. Like white separatists, they don't necessarily hold any negative views of other races. They're just tired of hearing their own race insulted. That's white advocacy, not white supremacy. Further out on the spectrum, you meet people who want a homeland for white people, with other races excluded. The definition of other races needs a lot of lawyering there. Jews? Muslims? How about Christian Arabs? Etc., etc. Leaving the lawyering aside, we're talking here about white nationalists. They want a white nation. They're white nationalists. That's what it means. I can't see any logic in calling them white supremacists. And then, way further out on the spectrum, you get to people who actually wish ill to non-whites, who would oppress, enslave, or massacre them if in power. These are generally called neo-Nazis, although that's not very accurate, as the actual Nazis counted a lot of whites, notably Jews and Slavs, among the outgroups to be oppressed, etc. In the fevered imaginations of liberals, all the groups I've worked my way through here nurse malice towards non-whites. A liberal who's listened to this segment of the podcast probably thinks that I do. Notwithstanding, I've been married for 30 years to a non-white. But that just shows you how stupid and immune to reason most liberals are. Is it fair to call this most extreme group, is it fair to call them white supremacist? I'll grudgingly allow that it might be. Grudgingly, because I've already passed the phrase white supremacist as a descriptor for other groups who don't wish any ill to non-whites. We really need a separate term here. I suggest white dominationists for whites who want to boss other races around, or worse. The opinion categories I've been enumerating are not mutually exclusive. We all hold lots of opinions. An individual might, without contradiction, be both a strong immigration restrictionist and a white separatist. Or both a white advocate and a white dominationist. The common thread is that holding any of these opinions will, in today's America, get you tagged as a white supremacist, whether or not you also hold any of the others. Well, those are my ruminations. The ruminations of a guy who, like Professor McWhorter, loves language and cares about the precise meaning of words. Hi there, Prof. Do you feel as lonely as I do? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. The excellent quantitative blogger who calls himself Audacious Epigon has constructed the following Jeopardy exchange between evergreen Jeopardy host Alex Trebek and bright green contestant Pepe the Frog. Trebek. For $1,000, blacks, liberals, and Democrats were more likely to vote for Donald Trump and less likely to vote for Hillary Clinton than this group of people. Beep. Yes, Pepe. Pepe the Frog. Who are residents of Washington, D.C.? Trebek. That is correct. That's the exchange, and Pepe is indeed correct. Nationwide, blacks went 89% for Mrs. Clinton, 8% for Trump. Residents of Washington, D.C., however, went 93% for the lady, only 4% for the Trump. That's all D.C. voters, all races. Likewise, people who identify as liberals nationwide went 84% for Clinton, 10% for Trump. The D.C. numbers, and once again, this is all D.C. voters, were 93 and 4. Democrats nationwide went 89% to 8, Clinton over Trump, 89 to 8. The D.C. numbers, one more time, all voters, 93 to 4. Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, is further left than any significant demographic you can name, with the possible exceptions of social science academics and mainstream media journalists. Mr. Trump is going to need all the help and encouragement he can get in draining that swamp. Item. Buzz Aldrin, the second human being to walk on the moon, was taken ill while on a tourist trip to the South Pole this week. He was evacuated from the pole to McMurdo Station on the coast, and I think is now in New Zealand. Aldrin is 86 years old. He's the oldest of the 7 remaining moonwalkers. As well as being the second person to walk on the moon, he was the first person to eat anything on the moon. It was a communion wafer. And he was the first person to urinate on the moon. Although not, of course, actually on the moon. The youngest of those surviving 7 moonwalkers, Harrison Schmitt, turned 81 in October. Soon they will all be gone, the last participants in the human race's most astonishing, most audacious, most wonderfully inspirational adventure to date. Gone with them will be the memory of a USA that could accomplish such marvels in those last years of heroic national vigour, before we turned our energies to guilt and rancour and divisive social crusades, and to persuading ourselves and each other that in the human sphere, everything is equal to everything else. Best wishes to Buzz for a speedy recovery from whatever ails him. Best wishes to our country for a revival of the spirit that sent him and his comrades on such a tremendous enterprise. Item. Christmas is coming, the goose is getting fat. They're saying happy holidays. What does Trump think of that? Not much. Here he was speaking on the campaign trail in September.
The word Christmas. I love Christmas. I love Christmas. You go to stores now, you don't see the word Christmas. It says happy holidays all over. I say, where's Christmas? I tell my wife, don't go to those stores. I want to see Christmas. No, I want to see Christmas. And, you know, other people can have their holidays. No, but Christmas is Christmas. I want to see Merry Christmas. Remember the expression, Merry Christmas? You don't see it anymore. You're going to see it if I get elected. I can tell you right now. I can tell you right now.
I'm not sure presidential authority extends to telling people how to greet each other. As so often with Mr. Trump, though, it's the attitude one approves. The attitude, in this case, of defiance to the anti-Christian, anti-traditional, multi-culti commissars. All strength to him. There you have it, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and my apologies once again for short measure this week. We don't get many news stories from Antarctica. That snippet at the end there may be our first on Radio Derb. I haven't checked. Whether it is or not, it's an excellent opportunity to air a clip from Ralph Vaughan Williams' Antarctic Symphony, a striking example of representational music. It actually sounds chilly. You might just want to pause the podcast and go turn up the thermostat. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.